Mr. and Mrs. Dunn Hedges, right?
Yep.
And Mrs. Hedges, what is your question?
Okay.
It's very nice that you come to visit me today. And for the Historical Society, I think this is the 18th of July, if I'm not mistaken, right? 18th, 1985. And it's an absolutely sparkling, beautiful morning. And I'm really looking forward to this interview. I thank you so much for coming. I'd like first to get some biological background done. Were you born in this area?
I was born in Pocatello, Idaho.
Oh my goodness. I've just gone through here on the train. I took a trip to California back on the train.
My father was a missionary to the Blackfoot Indians when I was born. And Pocatello was a major junction point at that time. She got ready to join them, she went by train.
Oh, that's wonderful. And what faith was your father?
He was a Presbyterian.
Presbyterian minister. And were your people then from England? The name Hedges or
basically England and Holland. Holland comes into it somehow.
I understand. It's exactly my husband's lineage. Mm-hmm. when you were young, what do you think that you had, that you showed special skills and talents when you were?
Oh, no. I just was a kid and grew up.
And when did you begin to show such talent, artistic?
Well, I don't know how to answer that. Because I was trained as an architect and basically
yes.
That's how I earned my living. I didn't begin to paint until I was about 60.
I see. Oh, that is marvelous. I'm really surprised to hear that. But I thought perhaps as a young child, you know, you might have had some special lessons or some special exposure to the arts in some way that sort of made you go
as long as I was always interested in art.
You went to museums. And where did you go to school?
I went to a whole series of schools. I finally graduated from Palo Alto High School in Palo Alto, California. Went for a year at Stanford and then transferred to Michigan. Finished schooling in Michigan, University of Michigan.
And so really most of your early life you spent born in the middle of the country, and then in the middle west, really.
No.
But Idaho is not considered.
No, that's
that's the west.
It's on the other side of the Rockies.
Oh, okay. That's right. I have to stop and think about that. That's right. But we came through Reno.
Well, you came probably came to a room.
Yes, we did, but anyway, we came to the through Sierra Madras as well. Were you, then, and you went to school in Palo Alto, what did you say?
Mm-hmm.
And where, what school was that?
Palo Alto High School.
High school. Did your parents then move down to that area?
Mm-hmm.
And then you went to Stanford? Well, Stanford.
Right.
Stanford. In California.
Mm-hmm.
And what ever brought you to the East Coast?
Well, Stanford was just completely beyond me financially. And I was working my way through school. I had a friend, a boyfriend, who I transferred to Michigan and was in the School of Architecture, and he wrote me and said, why don't you come on here and join me? It was that simple.
At Michigan, the tuition then at Michigan was easier?
Much easier. It's a state university. And,
yes.
At that time, an out-of-state student could go there for $300 tuition, which I could manage.
And that was in Eastern City?
No, that's in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Ann Arbor, I see. I bet my Michigan University, so there's one in Ypsilanti and one in Ann Arbor and one in
Eastern City.
So, and then, and did you meet Mrs.
I met Peg on the street in Ann Arbor.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Nature took on from there.
Were you studying there too? What was your
key? Well, I was mainly the guy. No, everyone just, you know, either went to Michigan State or University of Michigan. Which is the thing you did.
Were you from that area?
I was from Cadillac, Michigan.
Oh, yes.
The northern part of the world.
Oh, yes. So, then you and Don met and were married at... were you married there at Cadillac, Michigan?
Yes.
And then you moved to New Hope? How did you ever get to New Hope?
Well, we moved to Philadelphia because Don had a brother-in-law, Russell Block, who had a civic planning office. And Don worked in the office again for a year.
Two years.
And then how did you find New Hope? Was it through?
Well, the Depression came on about then, and Russell closed his office and moved out to his farm, which he had just bought near New Hope.
That is Russell Black.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we lived in the major. And he helped him build a ramp, helped him build a stone wall, and do things around the property because no one had any work. And I was pregnant.
The baby was born in the guest room at
no,
Russell
Black's? No, it was born in Philadelphia, but we were living
there. Well, you were living there, yes. So, well, that was your daughter, and your daughter's name is?
Mary Todd.
Oh, say. Mary Todd Hedges, and now where is Mary Todd?
She is 53 years old and lives in Charleston, West Virginia.
You have a daughter, 53 years old? Oh my goodness. You're much too young to have a daughter, 53
years old. Well, we've been married 54 years.
Oh my, that's wonderful. Well, congratulations. I hope that John and I can make 54 years. I'd like to be around for another few years to enjoy my children and grandchildren. Don, how did you get started in the architecture business here?
Sort of by chance. There were no jobs for draftsmen anywhere. New Jersey had a relief system for men who had professional offices that were closed, and they got $12 a week subsistence money. There was just nothing. Peg and I had always had a liking for shops of the sort we eventually had, and we had nothing to lose, and we were so young we didn't know the pitfalls, and we went ahead and opened a small old shop in New Hope, which at that time was just a very primitive little mill town, but had just started 2 art shows a year at Phillips Mill. And it's hard for you to realize how primitive New Hope was at that time.
I'd love to know. Describe it.
I saw New Hope the first time. I came up here with my sister who was working for the Philadelphia Tri-State Regional Planning Federation. A brand new thing. Planning had never been heard of before. And this was one of the first state sponsored attempts. And she came up here in this area to try and find out what communities had maps. There were very few. There were very few communities that maintained any records or maps of any sort. And the first time I ever came here, we drove up here in 1926. And we paid a toll at Hatboro and at 2 intermediate places, at the Paxson Estate in Lahanska, and at a small tollkeeper's place outside of New Hope. And in 1926, this road was not a public road.
You had to pay a toll to cross over a bridge?
No, to run
just
on the highway.
Just to run on the road.
To run on the highway between toll keepers.
You mean 202, the Paxson Farm on 202?
Well, there was no such thing as 202. This was, I guess, the New York Philadelphia Pike at that point.
Oh my goodness, that is really amazing. What kind of a toll did they collect? Was it very costly?
I don't know. It might have been 5 cents to.
But it was a toll.
To go from Hatboro to the next town. Well, we met.
Goodness.
At a wedding in 1935. We met a family from Harrisburg, and they said that we were from New Hope. This man took out his wallet and he said, "Our family fortune comes from New Hope." So we owned the toll bridge at New Hope, Library.
Oh, goodness. And what family was that, do you remember? Albert Rickard? Related to Dr. Rickard?
A twin. I don't remember the name. Darlington. Darlington was the name of the family. And at that time, one of the Darlingtons was a Episcopal bishop of Harrisburg. But, a few cents over a long enough period accumulates.
Oh, I should say, imagine the traffic that came over that road just to get to the toll bridge, to get over to New Jersey.
But there wasn't much traffic. You realize that, New Hope. Most of the streets in New Hope weren't even paved in 1926.
Oh my goodness, I didn't know. Really? Were they just dirt roads or cinder roads? A real country town.
And the town was owned and operated and controlled by the paper mill, which was owned by the Rubling family of New Jersey.
The Rubling family of New Jersey? Now, was the paper mill down on the river then?
Oh yes, the paper mill. The paper mill was on the river in 1812.
But there were other mills as well, right?
Well, see, there was the bag mill, which was also owned by them, but it was an entirely separate operation.
So I'm getting a picture then of New Hope in 1926 as a really extremely rural area.
And there were, the barges were operating on the canal at that time.
In 26 they were?
Oh, yes.
When did they stop? Wasn't it in the...
Well, 1932 or 3, when somebody invented a thing called an oil burner.
I remember my father so. But tell me, and I can remember those days when the oil burner was something.
Well, the restaurants like the Black Bass, the River's Edge, those were Saturday night tie-up places in whorehouses for the farm job.
Absolutely. I think that this is something that we're afraid to say.
And New Hope was considered such a rough town that people in Lambertville didn't let their children come across.
Oh my goodness. New Hope has had a very shady... Absolutely. Well, she's really an interesting little town now today as well. But isn't it amazing that that we think of New Hope as being such a lovely artistic community today, and yet the past was really had a very earthy kind of beginning, didn't it, with all the canal men loose on the river. That must have been a very hard life. I understand there was something like
everybody's life was hard in 26. Your house wasn't very warm. You didn't have washers and dryers. You didn't have air conditioning. You didn't have anything.
Yes, and I think because I grew up in that area, you know, I remember it extremely well. We didn't have shoes from the time school stopped until school started again. And, I would be sent to the store for one item. Go to the store and get one item. We didn't go to the store and just throw things in our basket like we do today. You know, go and get a can of peas, Rita, or go and get a pound of ground beef, something like that. You know. And I was growing up in those days, I remember now. I think that people don't remember, too, the salaries that were paid us in those days. My first job was in 1939, which is beyond that. But I earned $7 a week. Now this is the kind of wages that people earned during the Depression if they were lucky enough to have jobs. Yes.
Well, $12 was considered a subsistence amount of money for a man and his family. When we built our shop, and we paid the carpenters were paid 40 cents an hour. And the foreman got 75 cents.
When you built your shop. And you built that in what?
1936.
In 36? Mm-hmm. And what are they being paid today?
$12.50
an hour. Yeah. Things have changed a great deal, haven't they? One wonders how they these hardworking men supported families and that kind of money. But I understand they did reasonably well.
Well, everything was cheap. You could get a standing rib roast for, you know, $2.50.
Yes. Now it's $20.50 would be a good price. And a loaf of bread was what, about a nickel? And
there was even an ice cream cone for me.
Oh, I remember the 5 cent ice cream cone, I should say.
Well, the little main street in New Hope used to have street trees. Both sides of the street and almost continuously, and one of the reasons they went out of, they died, was the fact that there was an ice cream parlor where the village store is now, and they dumped the salt water from the ice cream freezer into the street and killed the trees.
Oh, terrible. But there were trees all lining. Tell me about your craft shop. You started, you seem to have all kinds of courage starting a craft shop when you did. And what kind of crafts did you
do? Well, Peg and I had both done some things. We made batiks when we were living in Philadelphia, and we were just sort of on the edge of craft stuff. And we called it the New Hope Craft Shop. Actually, it was just a retail gift shop because there aren't enough good crafts, and at that period you couldn't sell good crafts. So it was a store that carried nice merchandise.
Porcelains?
Yeah, more porcelain.
Gifts?
Pottery.
Pottery.
Things like sort of glass, china, and eventually had clothing, jewelry. It grew, and it was very small. It grew. been Peg's shop completely since 1938.
That's a long time.
When I began getting into architecture.
Well, tell me, which store is it now? Is it across from the bank or across from Mother's?
Right across from the bank parking lot. It's now called the Sloan Ranger.
Oh, I don't think I've seen that. Then there's a leather store next near it.
There's a brown bag.
And the brown bag shoe store.
And Hayes Fuller Studio is on the north side.
At what studio?
Hayes Fuller Studio.
Oh, Hayes Fuller Studio. It's changing so much down there. There are new things happening every day. And I see the old drugstore on the corner is now an absolutely huge toy store. And it's quite a spellbinder. But what has happened? What is Sloan? What is it? Sloan Ranger.
S-L-O-A-N-E.
And I wonder what they sell.
Well, they have somewhat the same kind of merchandise we have, but maybe more expensive. They're just starting, so they haven't. We had a lot of space. They had quite a ways to go yet to fill the space up.
I loved your shop, incidentally. I know which shop it is now. And you had some beautiful pottery.
It was entirely due to Peg. I had nothing to do with the shop that.
Oh, my goodness. Then you started in the architectural business.
My first job as a registered architect was at Bucks County Playhouse.
That's what I understand. And I really would like to get into that. I imagine, how were you contacted to, was this a building to restore the building?
A group of five or six young couples actually, living here, all of whom had some money. And they got together, and at that point, the mill was actually grinding grain on a contract basis down there. The farmer brought his bags in and ground. These people decided that they wanted to build a community center. But the high school had no facilities. Other than the high school, it was very new. The high school was only built in 1929. And they wanted to be a help to the school system, but they built a community center out in the playhouse. Then they, through one of the members of their group, they became very much interested in doing a summer theater. At that period, summer was a summer theater in Dennis and Kate. And maybe one or two others, but very, very few. Summer theaters were popular because there was no summer theater in New York. There was no air conditioning, so all the theaters closed. As a consequence, a fine actress like Ellen Hayes or somebody was willing to come out to a place like New York for a very small fee just to keep her name in front of the public. And after World War II, when air conditioning became general, summer theaters just went right down.
Well, that was a very short period of prosperity for them.
Right.
You built that in 39?
It was the day we started to tear it apart. The day before, it had been grinding grain.
Oh, my goodness, isn't that just amazing? And it had been it had been functioning for a good long time before you started tearing it apart.
Oh, years. Probably 100 years, I suppose.
Particular mill was owned by Harry's?
It was owned by a man by the name of Brown at that time. Mr. Perry, Perry's owned the what is now the Golden Gate Gallery building, and they owned the right-of-way to the river through there.
I see.
But they had gotten rid of the mill quite a long time ago.
Excuse me.
And
Mr. Brown purchased it?
Yeah.
I see. And then did these young couples that were just active in the community? Were they artists? Were they people from the theater that wanted to start a theater?
No, they weren't from the theater. No, these were all kids at that time who had, as I said, some enough income so that they could invest some money in a probably non-profitable operation. None of them had any, I don't think, had any idea that there would be any return from it, which of course they never did.
Oh, that's really quite a story, isn't it? I understand that the people that really sort of were behind this as well, there were some people from Broadway, is that right? Was there Richard Bennett, for instance? Did he have something to do with the...
Well, he came down here, but he had no financial interest in it.
I see. Do you remember who the people were that contacted you originally? Do you remember any of their names?
Well, Mr. and Mrs. Child from Wilmore. Mr. and Mrs. Cole from Newhall. Mr. and Mrs. Fallon. Mr. and Mrs. Henry Chapin.
And important names in our community today. Don Walker certainly had Broadway connections and connections in New York.
Well, he was the one who had the dream about making the theater. The rest of them just went along with the idea.
Mm-hmm. And the Bonsbys, of course, were Mr. Bonsby was an artist, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the Childs were what?
He was an artist.
Also an artist.
The Coles were part of textile. Mr. Cole was part of the textile operation in Yardley. And the Chapins, Mrs. Chapin ran a farm, and Henry was a writer.
Henry Chapin. And tell me, did that sort of trigger then the influx of all the celebrities from New York?
It changed the community completely. From the first night it opened,
it changed.
New Hope was never the same town again.
And before that, there were a lot of artists here, were there not? This was considered quite an artistic
community. I wouldn't say a lot, but probably 10 or 15, perhaps. Most of them taught in Philadelphia. Schools in Philadelphia. And they had come here as early as 1912.
I understand. Before we got up to the opening of the Playhouse, but before that, we had a rather well-populated community of artists just north of us on the river, right? Is that right?
Well, no, they were pretty scattered.
They were scattered.
It wasn't any tightly. There were about four families that were real close together, and then there were others on the fringe of it, and then there were some artists that lived here that those artists wouldn't have anything to do with.
Oh, is that really so?
Sure.
I didn't know that. I thought they were a very tightly knit group.
Well, younger artists couldn't get in the door.
Oh, really? Oh, my
no
goodness.
Way.
Poor young people, they always have to struggle in that kind of doors, don't they? I really feel sorry for them. But I understand there was a Leith Ross, Leith Ross, and
John Fallonsby, Daniel Garber,
Spencer,
Renfield,
Nye.
Bill Nye was a young artist, and he was considered a madman and wasn't permitted to
in the group. Why was he considered a madman? Was it his style?
Mostly because he was young, and he was very much influenced by Kandinsky, and was trying to produce his own version of Kandinsky. And these other men were absolutely strictly academic painters, and they would tolerate no deviation from anything.
They were academic painters, but they were in the Impressionist school, so yeah. They were...
Well, one of the some. Well, I think there were some Impressionists, and I think there were some just American landscape painters.
Mm-hmm. How about Ben Pickett? Wasn't he sort of both?
No, Pickett was a journeyman painter and was a true primitive.
A primitive.
And, he wasn't considered anything at that time. Nobody even knew anything about him. I guess he was living here, actually, at that time. He must have been rather elderly, but it wasn't until he died and the property was up for sale and some knowledgeable guy from New York went through the house and saw these stuff and realized there was something there.
Isn't that marvelous? It's marvelous that it was eventually discovered, but too bad that it wasn't discovered properly. You know, he could appreciate
it. Well, I think since the beginning of time, every time, you know, one generation of painters has nothing to do with the generation younger. They're scared to death of it. And they don't want to open the door any wider than possible.
That really is kind of sad, but it's true. I think today we still have traditional painters here, and that's good. I love the watercolors you're doing this year, but I love the oils that you do, especially. I don't want to, because you seem to have a style that is totally your own.
Well, I had no training.
Is that fun?
That's fun.
By just
if you have training, you
so
can't teach. You tend to do what your teacher told you.
Exactly. That is wonderful. That's why you have such a personal and individual style that I think is really very exciting, very vibrant, different. It's masculine and yet it's very delicate and beautiful. It's just really, it's really quite, it's really caught my eye.
That's a nice word.
It really caught my eye. Nice words, but what? I'd be glad to buy any painting that you decide to take the NSF sign off. How's that?
See you in the agent.
I'd love to see your work. So anyway, this was kind of a sleepy town, and then of artists and struggling families and industry and canal people and river people, and then the playhouse happened after the canal was closed. Right. And then the playhouse started.
Well,
and
suddenly
you really
see
started.
People began to come here,
right,
who had never been here before, because the playhouse brought a lot of actors and also one of the big influences in the town. A year before the playhouse had opened, by the name of Henrietta Cunningham, had bought Bill Nye's studio and turned it into a restaurant. And she had a terrible struggle. She was going to close, and was talking to me, and I said, well, hang on a little while longer. Not for any reason, I just said it. And she did, and suddenly the playhouse became an entity. And that changed her life completely.
And who was that? What restaurant was that in?
It was called the Topaz House.
Oh, the Topaz, my goodness.
And it was the only other restaurant in the area. It was Collins in Stockton.
Oh, I love that.
Which had operated as an actually open liquor serving restaurant all through the Prohibition years. They knew the right people in Trenton. And you could always get drinks from Collins.
I understand that's true. I think Ruth Worthington made the point that one of her husband's first job was to run the liquor into the Stockton Inn, and that's how he got his start. He really, we're not afraid, we're not ashamed to say that at the time. I remember it rather indistinctly. We used to have a few little bottles of things for an uncle of mine who was producing some very excellent booze in Chicago, and we would store some in our basement for him. But that was absolutely a terribly hushed up family secret. And now this is all coming out. These things are all, you know, because we realized that this was a...
well, speaking of running the liquor in, and the there were two Perry sisters who used to live in the Perry house in the summertime and then moved to Logan Inn in the wintertime because the Perry house had no heat. And we were living there then. We got to know them a little bit. They invited us only once to tea. And when we got there, they opened the closet. Here was a closet full of liquor. And Miss Perry said, my uncle in Boston sees that we're continually supplying.
Oh my goodness, isn't that terrific?
they were true. They were just like caricatures out of the New Yorker. They had almost no money. They were ladies, and they had been born maybe in that house, and they had gone to Baltimore by carriage to have their coming out party. And there was nobody good enough in this town for them to marry, and they ended up as just elderly ladies. And they wore little worn white gloves, and they had a little dog, and they used to take it out at night with a little piece of toilet paper and walk it around. They were really fabulous characters. They were very nice, a little vague, and it was a great experience to have met them.
Oh, my. Well, then, is that how that family faded out, then, the Perrys?
No, they had a brother, Oliver Randolph Perry. Two girls owned the house, but Randolph acted like he did. And he was the first person I think that I had known who actually had a mistress.
Oh, goodness, how wonderful.
He was maybe 15 years older than I was, and he had been an officer in World War I, and also he had been in Mexico with Pershing. Those were the greatest moments of his life, and he demanded to be called Captain Oliver Randolph. The day we started to work on the playhouse, one of the men on the job had left his car in the roadway that goes down in there, and Perry sent his cook over and had the car run in the river because he owned that right away, and no car could be on it. And he was a real home raiser.
Well, did he have his mistress there in the Perry Mansion?
No.
No, but he had her somewhere else. In the community?
No, she lived in Trenton, I think.
Oh, my. Well, was it a hushed up secret, or was it a rather well known secret?
People didn't talk much about mistresses then.
Was he a married man?
I'm sure he didn't ever have a family because after his sisters died and he died, the house was inherited by a niece.
Mrs. Lang?
Yeah.
I see. Her name was, and she was a niece of the family, and her name is now Lang, right?
I think so. I didn't know the Lang's name. Yeah.
I'm just getting to know all these marvelous things anyway, but you know, I remember these years of the rum running and the, as we call it, the booze and the bathtub gin and the stills in the basement and the home brew, everything that was very much a part of the 20s, I certainly remember, and it was a part of the New Hope scene as well.
Well, there was a still operating in Lumberville.
Really?
Yeah, you could go up there and buy. It was way up in the hill back of what is now Tinman's Lumber Yard. You could buy still run liquor for 3 $3 a gallon, you didn't dare drink it, it would kill you. But after a year, if you put it down, it became pretty good whiskey.
Really? What would it do, age in the barrels and it was all right?
The fuselage would be absorbed by the wood in the barrels. What
did they make it from? Grain?
Grain. Wheat?
Just wheat. It was just grain alcohol. Mm-hmm. Wow. Some mighty big fortunes have gotten started that way in this country, right? I'm thinking of old, what is it, good Daniels and... Some of the big whiskey industry started with a little still, probably. That's the way the country goes, I'm afraid. Well, I bet politics were kind of fun in those days, too. Politically, that must have been an interesting time as well. Was it hushed up that all this booze was going on? How did that...
No, I don't think that the American people ever took prohibition very seriously.
I think it was in the cities. I think it was a different feeling about making and selling liquor. I think that's how all the gangs got started in the cities. But certainly in the rural communities like this, it was just wide open, right?
No. In these places, you couldn't just go openly and buy the stuff. You had to.
It was secret.
Because it was still, they tried to enforce the prohibition of it.
They did. And how about the politics at that time? Were they... Oh dear, excuse me, I'll turn this. So we were talking about, when our telephone rang, we were talking about the politics in this town.
There were really only politics or Republican. They didn't even have Republican Democratic primaries. Absolutely iron hand. There was coal and there was votes to give out on election day, and you voted right or you didn't have your job in the mill.
And who got the booze?
The Republican Party. But that was the way the game was played everywhere.
I think so.
In Pennsylvania towns. It wasn't any different here than anyplace else, except there was only one party.
There was one party in this area, and that was Republican, right? Then the campaigns were, except outside of just being slightly irregular as they are throughout the country, in a one-party town like that. Was there anything else that was interesting in the political picture? Were there any personalities that were outstanding in that? Who was running? Who was the mayor? Say in the 30s.
Jim McGill's father. For a while, he was an eye surgeon. At Williams Eye Hospital in Philadelphia, had an office in Newhall for certain days. He was also an itinerant minister and a very, very colorful character.
Painter.
And a painter. And he and a man by the name of Dr. Turner. That was Dr. McGill, the eye surgeon, and Dr. Turner, who had been a veterinarian with the circus. I don't know which circus. And he and the two of those men ran the town with an iron hand, backed by the management of the war.
And a drink of whiskey didn't help when it was voting day.
Public relief. There was no county relief, there was no state relief. A community, if it had any relief at all, had it through its own local municipal government. I was on council in 1934, and I was a newcomer, and I was Democrat, basically. And the worst thing they could think to do to me after I was elected was to make me chairman of the board.
Chairman of the poor board?
And that is why the whiskey and coal became big for the, in the election period, because if you got promised a ton of coal, which is a real nice... I can't remember what year, it seems to me it was 1936. Dr. Flood was a dentist and a Democrat and a Catholic. The only Democrats in Newville at that time, pretty much, were Catholics. It was a very poor parish. But I think that was the same year that the state of Pennsylvania elected Democratic governor for the first time in the history of the state.
Oh, my goodness. Who was that?
Governor Earle.
Governor Earle.
And he was the Republican government had been fairly corrupt, but the Democrats hadn't had any peace with us for so long. We're so hungry to get their hand in the till. But by the end of the second year in office, everybody was convinced turn them out. Just because
really?
It was so corrupt.
And was that that was the Democratic Party? Was that when the Democratic Party got in?
Mm-hmm. And
who was that? Who was?
That was when Dr. Flood became the mayor of Newville.
What year was that?
I don't really remember. I think it was 1936 or 1938.
Isn't that too bad? And they just got their money into the till, and what did they do? Give it to the poor.
I didn't mean that Dr. Flood's group was involved in it. I just meant that on the state level.
The
Democrats were so anxious to get some of the dough that they... from the day he was elected, it just was a series of terrific scandals.
Governor Earle. But not Dr. Flood.
No.
But you were then... with the... Council for the Poor, is that what it was called? The Committee for the Poor? Committee for the Poor. Well, you certainly had some experience in being poor, having struggled the way you did when you came here.
We had surprisingly few people.
Really?
Who wanted help. Well, they were very independent people and proud of their independence, and a lot of them were just not interested in anything.
Wasn't that the good old American spirit, though?
And some people just were beyond that. They had to have help, but not very much.
Really? I can remember those days when it was considered a disgrace to owe anybody anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have plastic money and we charge things, but in those days, if you ran up a bill at a local store, you couldn't wait to pay it. And it was a totally different kind of financial integrity that we reached for. Don't you think so? We were terribly concerned about being solvent.
I still have that feeling. I must have had it so long.
Well, mostly there was no such thing as time payments.
Right.
Before then. The advent of the automobile and permitting people to buy on time changed the whole concept of everything.
I just don't think people understand that. Yeah.
And it was no longer, then it became no longer shameful to pay something off over a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
There's another thing that happened when Roosevelt came in that hardly anybody realizes, and that is that there was no such thing as an amortizing mortgage.
Amortizing mortgage.
In other words, when you got a mortgage, or whatever it was, that interest was paid on that full amount for X number of years, usually five, and then you were expected to make a big payment and reduce that, which nobody ever did.
I remember that.
And it wasn't until Roosevelt's administration that the idea of an amortizing mortgage, when you automatically are paying something back on the principal.
Yes.
Even became an
Oh, that really changed the whole financial structure of the country then, didn't it? That really is amazing. I've never had anyone bring that up before. That's a very interesting point. Is that the kind of a mortgage they took out on the Playhouse?
Playhouse was paid for in cash.
Really?
The first year. In the second year, they took out a loan to build an addition.
And what addition was that? Was that true?
They enlarged it by almost 200 seats. The night it opened, I think it only held 200 and some persons, and eventually was enlarged to 420.
I see. And had you done the initial work then, or the initial designing for the 200 seat?
Mm-hmm. And then for the other.
And then for the 420 that came after that. Do you remember what opened that night? Do you remember the opening of the Playhouse?
Springtime for Henry.
And who was it?
With Edward Everett Horton.
Oh, yes, I remember
and
him well.
The toilet rooms weren't finished, and they had to get him a bucket.
Oh, really?
Almost nothing was finished.
Oh, I bet he was such a fussy man. I can't imagine him having to use a bucket.
He was a very smart man under that fussiness, because when he came out here, they gave him his check. I don't remember what it was. But he said, "I'm sorry, I've had checks, I'll take cash."
Oh my goodness, wasn't he smart? Well, he certainly must have said some good things to the people back in New York, because he sort of started a string of people coming out here then, didn't he?
Well, as I said, a summer theater was very attractive to New York actors, because they got to work in all year. Otherwise, they had no work.
Do you remember? Did you meet any of these people? Do you remember the Playhouse?
Oh, the Playhouse.
Do you remember the? It was the Bambergers who were
the Bamberger. The Bamberger really made the Playhouse. He did a very good job of running it, and he was an exceptional person.
And it's Theron.
Yeah,
Theron Bamberger, and his wife was Phyllis Bamberger. I understand they were quite a good couple. They really worked well as a team.
They were in the house, you know.
Right up here on Sugan.
On
Phillips Mill. You don't remember what house it was, do you? It's mentioned in some of the literature.
Right at the turn to Ely Road.
The
driveway is the first driveway east of Ely Road.
Okay, that's good to know where that was, because I think they were important in our past. I understand they also brought some people here who decided to live here, and I have in mind the what's his name, Moss?
Moss Hart,
yes. And
They came before Theron.
They did?
Yeah, they came almost immediately. That's why I think the first 2 years of the Playhouse were pretty exciting, because he and Kaufman were right at the peak in New York at that time. They both came out here, and they both played in the Playhouse. They played in George Washington Slept Here.
Oh, wonderful.
And the opening of that thing, it was like a New York opening. It was all black tie and everything. It was a big deal in a little country town.
Well, I should say. It was black tie theater. Is that right? You mean people came to the theater dressed in
Well, an opening with George
Kaufman.
With George Kaufman and
Moss Hart.
The Marx Brothers?
Really?
All in that production. And,
oh.
And there was some girl with a big bosom who went on to bigger things. had that walk-on in the park.
Martha Ray?
I can't remember who she was.
I can remember it's Martha Ray.
She had a big body.
She had a big body. But she also, she was well-stacked, as they say. But I know that, you know, there have been so many memorable people here that we just don't know where to begin talking about them. But did you have any personal contact with these people? Did you have any stories to tell about?
Not really, really. I used to see them. I spent quite a bit of time down at the playhouse at that time because there were still things to be done. But
mm-hmm.
And these were people I knew and nodded to, but I didn't socialize them.
There was a manager down at the playhouse, a stage manager. What was his name? Tubby, kind of.
John Crowley.
Crowley, Mr. Crowley,
well,
yes.
He came later. He wasn't in that early period.
Oh, he was not.
See, a lot of things happened after the end of World War II. In 1940, I guess, they decided to, no, it wasn't until after Pearl Harbor. They decided that they couldn't operate the theater out here in the country during the war years.
And they closed it down?
And the theater in New Hope was closed, and we told the Philadelphia Electric Company to turn off the electricity to the building, and it used mm-hmm. large amounts of electricity, and they said they would turn it off, but if they did, they would not guarantee us money when the war, guarantee us power when the war ended. So for all the war years, we paid blackmail to Philadelphia Electric Company.
Just to keep the electricity.
And the theater operation was moved into the Bellevue Stratford in Philadelphia.
Oh my
by Thera,
God.
By Theron. Then.
Theron did that.
Right. So, and then, I think Crowley was in the service at that time.
I see.
And after the war ended, and they opened here, Crowley came in and became a very popular stage manager.
And how about years that followed then? Was it a successful venture in the 50s, in the late 40s?
Very successful for a while. And then, as I said, Ed Benev Air Conditioning in New York, that meant that you could only, that Ellen Hayes was making $2,000 a week in New York. She had to be paid $2,000 a week when she came out here. With a 400-seat house, you just couldn't do that.
No.
So that the quality of the performers, you know, began to get less and less.
There has to be other expenses for a production.
Yeah.
Than to pay stars. Was that the problem you were starry
with? With a 400-seat house, you just couldn't. Bring somebody wonderful.
Oh, isn't that sad? And I imagine it's still sort of stuck in that.
Well, it has to run on a semi-amateur basis.
Mm-hmm.
No, there's no other way they can operate.
There was an outfit in here for a couple of years recently that was had equity people coming in, but it couldn't carry, could it?
I think the present operator seem to be doing a pretty good job. They have. One of the good things in their case is the fact that they have a contract with the Philadelphia school system.
Oh.
And they bring thousands of school children here by bus.
Oh, I didn't know.
Every year to see a theatrical production, and most of these kids will never see another production in their lives. And this was partially federally funded.
Is that Ron Miller who owns it now?
I think Miller and Aiken.
Miller and Aiken?
think so.
I see.
But I'm not at all familiar with the present uh-huh. operation.
Well, I know that they lost their equity stars or their
They lost an agreement with equity to let them pay less than scale.
That was the big thing.
And I think that that's the case of a couple of guys getting mad at each other. And I don't think it had to end up there. But the theater, like everything else, is full of very great egos. And I don't know. That's one man's opinion.
Do you think we should enlarge it and make this a... what do you think we should do with New Hope in the theater? Do you think it should be reopened in a larger scale? Do you have any ideas what...
it's impossible. It's impossible to enlarge it because you can't solve the parking anyway. I made plans to enlarge it. Mm-hmm. That part will work. There's no way you can get parking. And unless you have parking, people aren't going to come. They thought of running buses down from the, but people won't come.
Down from the school, you mean?
Yeah.
From the New Hope Solberry? Yeah. Well, New Hope does have a parking problem. It seems they're trying to solve it at the south end of town at this point with some new kind of parking arrangements. But it would still require some sort of a shuttle or whatever to get people here for the playhouse. I really understand that you were involved in other things besides the playhouse and that you've done a lot of architectural work, especially now Ruth Worthington told me that you did some work or that you did some redesigning of her place there at the Rabbit Run Farm.
Yeah.
Did you do that sort of thing mm-hmm. in this area?
Yeah. I did a lot of architecture work.
Is there any work in particular that you care to mention that you're especially proud of, perhaps?
Well, I don't know. It's difficult to pick out individual things. I just have a general experience with a lot of people and
there's so many old, beautiful stone homes in this area that have been... It seems that people, unlike the Middle West where I'm from, people here really love the old homes and they put their life savings into them, you know.
This was done largely because they had lots of stone in this area and people who built these houses came directly from England, and they built the stone in England, so they built the stone here.
But there was a lot of fields.
You go over to New Jersey, there are very few stone houses.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Almost none.
I wonder why.
I think it came from some other area.
Mr. Nakashima is also an architect. Did you ever work with him, Did your work ever?
No, we passed in cross and also we're entirely different in our feelings about architecture.
Yes.
And his training and mine were completely different.
I understand he considers himself more a woodworker. He says, I am a woodworker. I am a worker of wood.
What? True, yeah.
And with you, it was architecture. But did you design any new buildings, perhaps, in this area?
Well, this I tore the bank apart 2 or 3 times, and I did the last addition to the bank.
Oh yes.
Well, I did the whole building where the Delaware Bookshop is.
The Delaware Bookshop?
Farley's?
I see. Is that what they call it?
That whole area.
Oh, that must have been a very, very old building.
And I did the Four Seasons Mall.
Four Seasons Mall?
which used to be,
really? Oh,
which used to be Ruth Worthington's husband's garage.
That's what she said. Well, that was very cleverly done for that. You know, there is so much there for a very small piece of real estate.
They did the post office and the liquor store.
The old post office?
No, right in Newburgh.
The one that's in Newburgh. Yeah. I see. And the liquor store next to it?
Next to it.
My goodness, you really did change the shape of New Hope,
and
didn't
the
you? Bamberger's house?
Mm-hmm.
Ben Badura's house. Ben Badura, the artist.
Yeah.
My goodness. Well, now, then you worked as an architect from, say, the 1938 or 1939 through to, and you're still doing work as an architect.
Right.
We've been through we've sort of skipped through the 50s in a way, and was there anything interesting happening, especially in the 50s when you were here? The 60s. How about the yippies and the hippies? Did they change the face of New Hope too?
They sure changed the face of New Hope.
Did they? I imagine this was a great attraction for the hippie generation.
I think they were very disappointed. We got New Hope. It wasn't really a salt hole. Or a Haight-Ashbury.
It was not.
They left quite a legacy of drug stuff in New Hope, which is still there and which is still in most communities. It was a very frightening period.
I think the concerned with, or I understand that the underground word is that there's lots of drugs south. That is the drug triangle. And when you see some of the type of people down there, you wonder if there isn't some truth to this. Is the this is where all the motorcycles line up on Friday nights and weekends. You know.
They're up on our way too.
And where is your way? Is that
across the bay?
Oh, across the bay, really?
We live upstairs.
Oh, I see.
See, there are two restaurants.
Yes.
Up in our area, and also. That has changed that again, and that brings night people.
Mm-hmm. The Landing and Mother's across the street.